All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome to the gold standard that is episode 50 of the SLS Cast. By God, we've gone almost a fucking year. Yeah, non-stop, continuous episodes, episode 50. And in, like, wedding terms, that's, like, the gold anniversary. So, hell yeah. I am Matt.
Now we can have that little... this is Tim. And now we can have that little emblem, that little status saying, like, celebrating 50 episodes of podcasting, the SLS Cast.
Yes, and I like how you didn't
setting
put
standards.
Any other adjective or adverb, depending on how you want to use the term podcasting, beyond the word podcasting. It's not like 50 episodes of podcasting excellence. It's just 50 episodes of podcasting.
But the letters, how it's written out, looks so pretty and so glamorous. It just kind of makes up for the lack of prestige at the end of it.
Indeed. And actually, yeah, it's kind of funny because here we are with this, we're kind of testing our new format here where we're trying to lighten up on the editing and just kind of a little bit more free-flowing and trying to keep it a little tighter and sharpened and as we go here. And it's reminding
tightened what? And sharpened?
Well,
pencil
it's not a vagina.
References.
Reference. Okay, I thought we were worried about, like, you know, sexual references or something. Which goes
education.
Back to what I was trying to say, because we got so involved in your AFM shindig for a recording last week that I never got to talk about my family reunion where I was at the weekend before last. And there I talked to my family and I was meeting with cousins and stuff like that, and my cousin Jason was telling me how he listened to the show, and of course he is a little bit older than me, you know, and so he has kids, and his oldest son, I don't want to get too out there and start naming kids of other family members if I don't have express permission, but his oldest son was like, I kind of heard about the show, but I haven't actually listened to it myself, and I'm like, okay, well, it's kind of adult, because, you know, he's not 18, let's say. And so I told him I was going to try and keep us a little bit more PG-13, and so far failing miserably at that. We've opened the last two shows with me saying fuck.
God damn it, son of a bitch.
Here's my extended family never being able to listen to the show.
Welcome to the fucking SLS Cast.
There you
Welcome.
Go. Yeah,
Welcome.
That's right. I mean, you know, and we'll just see how it goes. It's not like he doesn't go to public school where he hears worse than this every day anyway, but it's about what you choose to expose your kids to. And I got to respect that. So one of these days, you know, I'll find out if he ever gets to listen. Probably not going to be these two episodes, though. Anyway... Speaking of my family reunion, I actually have kind of an essay. It was an inadvertent essay that I kind of posted to Facebook yesterday, and I would like to disseminate to you. Did you notice I didn't say inseminate?
I was about to say. I'm glad you said the former than the latter.
And here it goes. So, back at the family reunion, my Quentin family reunion, my cousin Joel, brother of Jason, actually, it was just kind of it, Joel, had asked me about what he referred to as basically the Desert Island Blu-ray collection. And this would be the five movies that I could watch over and over and over again should I be stranded on a desert island with a solar-powered Blu-ray player / viewer. Now, I very rapidly chose, and in this order... Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan, National Lampoon's Vacation, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, Star Wars Episode V: The Empire Strikes Back, and Wuthering Heights from 1939. Those are just movies that I love and I know that I could watch over and over and over again, and it pretty much covers the gamut of movies. You've got some action movie, you got some sci-fi, you got a Christmas movie in there, you got a serious drama, romance thing, and then you've got comedy. So I was like, heck yeah, that's good for me. But then he asked me what five movies I felt were the most important to share with my children. And that was much harder. And it literally took me from the end of from that day, it was the Friday before my family reunion, and I had been thinking on this through yesterday when I finally had narrowed down my list. And it is in this order. Number one, Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. On the list in the number one spot is this movie because of how groundbreaking it was and because I want to impart that sense of wonder that made such an impact on my childhood. Besides, if I end up with super hot geek kids, I'm pretty sure that's some kind of jackpot. Number two, It's a Wonderful Life. Coming in at a very close second was this film. While definitely Capra-esque and somewhat cheesy, this is one of my favorite Christmas movies. Not only that, but I believe it to be of the utmost importance that people understand how their actions affect others. To that end, I want for my children to understand that even when you don't see it or understand fully, believing in doing what is right will be rewarded. Number three, To Kill a Mockingbird. This is quite possibly one of the best movies of all time. That being said, how dare I commit the sacrilege of placing it third on this list? Because juxtaposition, that's why. While It's a Wonderful Life speaks to the importance of doing the right thing and seeing the effect that you have on others, this film demonstrates the one thing that all children need to learn: injustice. I distinctly remember this film's impact on my life, and two things followed. The desire to make sure no one goes through this if I can help it, and realizing that Gregory Peck was quite possibly the greatest actor I had ever seen to that point. Number four, The Quiet Man. Quiet, possibly my favorite John Wayne movie. You see what I did there? That's right, I'm a nerd. You love it? This film makes the list because I want for my children to experience a classic romance with the majesty of breathtaking scenery. The best part of this romance is how remarkably true to life it is. It's not just sweeping music and boy meets girl so they can fall in love romance. It's complicated and somewhat contrived. Roadblocks put up in front of the couple are basically put there by themselves, and there's just as much passion for their differences as there is passion for romance. Not to mention, it's just as humorous as it is touching, and Victor McLaughlin gives the performance of a lifetime. And how about that redhead Maureen O'Hara? Oh yeah. Finally on the list, number five from 1973, Sleeper. Closing out the list in the final spot is a movie that my mom had to make me watch. For me, this is Woody Allen's funniest film and a true comedy. When she initially described to me the story of a cryogenic fish out of water, I was, shall we say, unconvinced. Then, as they pulled the aluminum boil off of Woody Allen, that's right, foil, in the opening moments of the movie, I laughed. A lot. From there, I was sold and was treated to a fantastic farce, for when the kids get older, mind you, that has remained in my mind what all comedies should aspire to. For the record, I was 16 when I saw this movie for the first time, so please plan your child's viewing schedule of Sleeper accordingly should you give this list a go. Well, that's my list. I'd love your thoughts. If you agree, disagree, or just want to know exactly what it was I was thinking when I came up with this list. Also, feel free to share with us what your movies would be, and/or just share this to others in general.
I'm sorry, I was in the bathroom. Would you mind repeating all that again?
Sure. So I was at back at the Quentin Flame reunion, and
very interesting. I like Sleeper. That's a very interesting movie to pick. And funny thing is that I don't think the last time I watched that movie was whenever I was 16. I don't think I've ever watched it since, and it was only that one time. So I think I need to go back and rewatch that one for the sake of your favorite movie picks, or your most influential picks, I guess.
I mean, for the reasons listed, I mean, for me, these are the movies that I want to impart. I want to make sure that my kids sit down and watch. And yes, Sleeper's going to have to wait till they get older. I understand that. But I wanted something that really represented classic cinema. I wanted something that was inspiring to me. I wanted stuff that that was important, that taught life lessons, because I think it's great how movies can do that. And I did, but I wanted something, but I wanted to make sure that there was stuff that was fun as well, and to really kind of cover that broad spectrum.
Well, if that's the case, if you wanted movies that teaches life lessons, where's Flashdance and The Paperboy? The Paperboy teaches you what to do when you know, you get stung by jellyfish.
That's true. It also teaches you what to do when you find out that your brother is a homosexual sadist.
You know, that can happen. That happens.
It's entirely
in Texas
possible.
On a daily basis.
Yes.
Daily basis.
Yeah. But at any rate, so, you know, that's... So I just wanted to share that with you guys. It was something that I thought was cool, I was really proud of, and I wanted to share as really and truly my first real and official essay for the show, which we haven't done since, like, February.
Yeah, I know. You're almost 10 months late on a...
Well, I was going to do another one on the importance of not bringing your children into theaters, but that just kind of turned into a live-action diatribe on the show. So
exactly.
I never ended up doing...
But it worked.
Say on that. Exactly. What about you? So that kind of covered... Because I didn't have anything exciting that happened last week. And so it was nice to, you know, tie that into my family reunion, which I didn't get to talk about the week before, which, by the way, was an absolute blast. Our family reunion auction was very successful this year, brought in a lot of money for the fund, and we had, you know, marshmallow fight and a moonwalk and armadillo hunts and stuff. It was just a complete blast and good fun, good times.
And you had, as party favors, Lilo I-80s and... And crack,
just for the late night session. That was after the kids went to bed.
Right. Well, okay. So there's a thing to follow up your very, I almost said sensual essay. I don't mean sensual. I mean heartfelt essay. A look into Matt's life, which I guess can be sensual if you look at. Well, never mind. Okay, so at the conference, at the AFM conference, the American Film Market, which the other day I was telling somebody about it, and I said, it's the AFM market, you know, the African film market. And, yeah, that doesn't work out. There is a trailer that they kept playing repeatedly throughout the 8 days I was there, with full surround sound, and it was on the other side of the convention floor, and everybody could hear it. Even if you tried not to hear it, you can still hear this trailer. And lo and behold, I was on YouTube and I stumbled across it. And I would love to get Matt's commentary while watching this trailer for the first time via YouTube. So Matt, on your computer, on YouTube,
I'm ready.
If you can type in Death Grip Trailer, three words, that is death, that is grip, and that is trailer.
Okay, I have... Martial arts thriller Death Grip, theatrical trailer Johnny Young Bosch and Eric Jacobus.
That would be it.
Do we want Death Grip AFM trailer? One is 2 minutes long, by stunt people from 2 years ago with 5,200 views. Or the one that's from 1 year ago, that's a minute 43, that has 43,500 views.
Well, to save you the 17 seconds of additional ridiculousness, go with the top one, the martial arts thriller, Death Grip, theatrical trailer from a year ago.
Oh, this ought to be good. All right, here we go, folks. I have clicked, and thanks to my awesome YouTube extension, I don't have to wait for this fucking thing to load. It loads the whole thing before I even start, instead of by piecemeal. Get your YouTube extensions, y'all. They're good.
Yeah, yeah. Shameless plugins for revenue that we are not receiving.
All right, here we go. Action-packed. A whole bunch of stuff that's going... A mysterious coin. It's very high def. That some would kill for. Oh, but... Oh, wow, that was a terrible hit. Holy crap. Everything sounds like a punch to the midsection. Even punches to the face. And bats to the head. I'm sorry, we couldn't pay all these actors and get more than one sound effect. Wow. Oh my god, this is terrible. It's like this guy is a bad Joel Edgerton from Warrior. Holy crap. And then they have some guy in a surgeon's mask. Oh no, he's just wearing like bandages or something? Oh, there's a new sound effect! It's like the knife sound effect. Death grip. Wow. That's terrible, dude.
Yeah, I like that obligatory shot that was made famous throughout the early to mid 2000s of flipping the guy over and his foot just barely nicks the above hanging light, causing it to swing. But usually in more bigger budget movies that can actually afford a light bulb to put in that light, it would create this cool little light effect where the light's kind of swishing back and forth. And actually, there's a reason behind why they had to show this guy's foot, elegantly choreographed with precisionists, if that's a word, precisionists, of hitting that light to cause it to move. So, yeah, I just wanted to share that with you. I encourage all to check it out, the trailer that is. I mean, who knows, maybe the movie's good, maybe it's not. So, yeah. Death grip.
It kind of sounds like something that a guy would have on their penis right as they're about to ejaculate. Death grip. No? Okay, that's all right.
Well, I really do hope that your third nephew, or whatever he is not listening to this episode, because I would hate for him to learn about
choking the chicken. I guess, strictly speaking, he would be a third cousin, because he is a son of a second cousin. Yeah, son of a second cousin by marriage, I think, if I got it right.
Death grip!
All right, well then let's just jump right into the fun stuff here. You ready?
Yes, sir.
Let's do it.
The news!
All right, the news. Okay, so...
Death grip the news.
The news, death grip style. All right, so I don't really have anything in-depth to talk about. So if you've got an in-depth news story, let's hear it, because I'm ready for our Spitfire round again, our weekend update style.
Okay, it's not really in-depth, more so that it's like two paragraphs. Russian government... The Russians, the Ruskies, they want to form an agency that'll be in charge of copyright control, and that who would have to report to directly to the Russian government. And now, the Russians are doing this at a time when not only Russia is actively pursuing these certain avenues and attempts to put a stop to the piracy that's kind of getting out of control, well, according to some people, it's getting more so out of control. Especially with all of the access to digital and people able to find certain movies available to stream opposed to download. But however, the UK, Canada, and the United States, and probably Mexico, but who knows about Mexico, are looking to put a stop to piracy as well. According to the Hollywood Reporter, quote, over the last few years, Russian film producers have named piracy among the most pressing issues for the sector, which only the government could properly address, end quote. Now, experts estimate that the value of Russia's pirated video market is about more than $200 million a year. That is a lot. $200 million, which I guess a lot of that money could be going to Disney. Maybe they need that extra $2 million to fund the new Star Wars movie. But we all know that of what we've seen in the trailers and of the previews and commercials that they ran for like a year or two some time back, that piracy does not only affect the studios themselves, but it's like a trickle-down effect. It affects the set dressers, the prop masters, the background talent. It kind of affects the little guy in a way. So I can understand this push for putting an end to piracy. Now, in other pirated movie news, it turns out that many of the most pirated movies aren't available for legitimate online purchases. That's right. In October, the most downloaded / pirated movie, was Pacific Rim. And it also happens to not be available for digital download nor streaming. Now, number 2 and number 3 on the list were both White House Down and Elysium. And they also were not available for digital rental or streaming either. They can't even be purchased digitally. Now, could this be another reason for us to support the CEO or whoever, the guy from Netflix who is demanding that movies be available for both home and movie theater viewing? Is it the fault of the studio executives and distributors for not making certain movies easier to download or better accessible online for streaming or whatnot? Or is it perhaps all irrelevant because people will illegally download a movie regardless of its accessibility? Because, you know, people will still be lazy bastards or cheap.
Well, okay. There's always going to be the segment of people who are going to pirate, no matter what. You're not going to get rid of them. Those are the people who don't care what you do. However, it's been shown time and again that when you give the people what they want, when they want, piracy goes down. A lot of times, it's just availability. It's availability combined with convenience. And the biggest problem of all is the people, these big corporations, who go so far out of their way to address the problem of piracy, literally are cutting off their nose to spite their faces. If they would just give the people what they want, when they want it, they would see the piracy go down. But no, they have to go through all these different channels, all this different bullshit to come up with $2 million saved. And the sad part is that's still not helping the small little guy. And most of the small little guys don't care about piracy because they know the real secret behind piracy. When somebody gets something for free and then they like it, they go and buy the other stuff because now they want to support it. It's like giving them a taste. Isn't it amazing how I never answer your fucking question? No, I really don't think that... I think piracy's always going to be there, and that the companies... The big corporations really and truly make mountains out of molehills so they don't have to address the real issue.
There you go. Yeah. Matt has spoketh, or doth speaketh, or spoketh. Well, that's pretty much all I have for in-depth news, or I'm not going to have any Spitfire news.
First up in the Spitfire round, since you went first last week, I'll go first this week. From Variety.com, courtesy of Stuart Oldham, Gravity rises to $500 million at the box office worldwide. This now makes it Sandra Bullock's and George Clooney's largest grossing film ever. Bullock's previous highest grossing film was Speed, while Clooney's benchmark was Ocean's 11. So, yay, people are excited. Good stuff. And it goes to go on to note that they do realize that a certain percentage of this movie is because a lot of people went and saw it in 3D.
The big selling point right there.
It is.
Florida-based Star Partners, a company that has co-financed such classic flicks such as Rain Man and The Color Purple, and those are definitely two movies that are on opposite side of the spectrum. They have teamed up with Hummingbird, a company that is one of the biggest producers of music for commercials, to develop It's a Wonderful Life, the rest of the story. The sequel to, that's right, the 1946 Jimmy Stewart classic, It's a Wonderful Life. And this has been confirmed by The Hollywood Reporter. The original is about showing a good guy can win, and with Scrooge, you have a person that is not a good guy, but he changes, says Hummingbird's Bob Farnsworth. Quote, "This story is about the amazing human capacity to forgive when we see someone change for the better," end quote. The movie will center on George Bailey's daughter, Zuzu, and the original actress, her name was Carolyn Grimes, she will return, and her not-so-good grandson. And it's about their relationship. I think she plays an angel looking after him or something. I don't know. The budget will be between $25 and $30 million, and it will be aiming for a 2015 holiday release. I don't know. It sounds a little too Lifetime-y. Like, you know, Lifetime presents the sequel to It's a Wonderful Life. It's a Wonderful Life. The rest of the story. It's kind of like a crappy sequel title.
It's like Paul Harvey coming back in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
70 years later.
Star Wars From Episode the 5, the second part of the story. You know, just weird. It needs something like a catchy title, something with flair, you know?
What, are you kidding? You just infused Paul Harvey, you know? It's a Wonderful Life. The rest of the story, good day. That's how he ended all of his broadcasts.
Right,
good day.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Jimmy Stewart's turning in his grave somewhere. Yeah.
From Variety.com, courtesy of Dave McNary, it looks like, and this comes from, this actually was slated from the AFM that you were at. Samuel L. Jackson joins John Cusack in Stephen King's Cell. King's story, published in 2006, follows a New England artist struggling to reunite with his son after a mysterious signal broadcast over the digital global, after a mysterious signal broadcast over the global cell phone network turns humans into mindless, vicious animals. So, this sounds interesting. They were actually shopping this film around for buyers at the American Film Market. So, that's kind of cool. I hope that they got some good stuff. Samuel Jackson did officially come on board. He was co-starring with John Cusack. They had previously starred together in 1408. So, that's good.
And that was a Stephen King.
Yes, it
was.
Based
off a Stephen King
that's
story
right
as well. Yeah. Writer Joe Hill has been working hard to bring an adaptation of the IDW comic book Lock and Key to the big screen. However, the major setback has been Fox, who have shot and has currently sitting on a shelf somewhere an unaired pilot of Lock and Key that they shot back in 2012. Joe Hill, the writer, told MTV that Universal, the studio that currently has movie rights, quote, wants to avoid spending $25 million on a movie and then have Fox steal their thunder by releasing a three-year-old pilot, end quote. Interestingly, this stuff actually happens. But luckily, this is not pertaining to something that we've actually heard of.
Indeed. From Deadline.com, courtesy of the Deadline team. Dumb and Dumber to hit theaters in November 2014. That's right, folks. November 14th, 2014 to be specific. And if you're scoring along at home, that'll be 3 weeks short of the 20-year anniversary of Dumb and Dumber. Yeah.
Robert De Niro tells The Guardian that he'd like to be in a sequel to Taxi Driver and reprise his role of Travis Bickle, the famous role of Travis Bickle, I might add. You talking to me? Yeah, well, you know it. I don't have to repeat it. De Niro says that, quote, "I'd like to see where Travis is today. There was something about that guy, all of the age and alienation, That's what the city can do to you. End quote. But don't worry. Don't worry. Don't worry about it. I'm pretty sure we won't have to worry about a sequel. Because while promoting his movie The Canyons on Reddit, screenwriter Paul Schrader was asked by somebody if he had ever been approached to write a sequel to Taxi Driver. And he said that De Niro had suggested it 15 years ago, and quote, "I told him it was the dumbest idea that I've ever heard. The character had died not more than 6 months later," end quote.
From BloodyDisgusting.com, courtesy of Mr. Disgusting, what the fuck? Was Brittany Murphy poisoned? Turns out that the rap's breaking some shocking news that states that a new laboratory report lends credence to what actress Brittany Murphy's father has long suspected, that she and her husband died not of natural causes, but of poisoning by someone out to kill them. Quote, "It's a bona fide report. It was our client's prerogative to release the report. That's all I can tell you," end quote. The lab found evidence she was poisoned, probably by a, quote, third-party perpetrator with likely criminal intent, end quote, according to the report, which was authorized to be released. The report found that Murphy's body had dramatically elevated levels of aluminum, magnesium, barium, and other metals. Pow.
And guys, guess what? I have another piece of Kick in the Bell news.
As far as playing him in a movie, that's such an obtuse rumor that I never had the pleasure of cultivating. That's not my idea.
Some weeks ago, The Wrap had reported that the star of HBO's Girls, Adam Driver, was a serious contender to play Nightwing in the upcoming Batman vs. Superman movie. However, this has been proven to be more speculation than anything else when Driver on HuffPost said, quote, "No, there's no truth to that. I don't know whoever put it on there. I don't know how these things get started," end quote. Good news is that that means that Matt Damon still has a chance to don those tights.
And that's what's important. Coming to us from Collider.com, courtesy of Christina Radish, Paul Walker says Fast and Furious 8 is guaranteed and opens up about James Wan being the new director. This is a great little article here. I definitely recommend that you read it. He goes into great detail about what it was like to work with him and get to know him, and how happy he was at the kind of guy he was and at the kind of guy that Juan is and everything. But yeah, just be looking for Fast and Furious 7 coming out in the summer of 2014. And James Wan is officially at the helm, has been directing it. And it could, this basically means that he won't be back for Insidious Chapter 3, which we'll get there. However, Walker also got into saying that no matter what happens with Fast and Furious 7, even if it tanks, there's going to be an 8. However, if they do well, they could go all the way to Fast and Furious 10.
Sid Field, a well-known screenwriting teacher and writer of many books on the subject, passed away. He was born in 1935. He passed away on Sunday of hemolytic anemia. Hemolytic? It's either hemolytic anemia or hemolytic anemia. The end.
I got that. All right, coming to us from metro.co.uk. Christian Bale reveals the one piece of advice he gave new Batman Ben Affleck. Here it is, folks. Quote, "The only thing I said to him is to make sure he can take a piss without anyone having to help him, because it's a little bit humiliating. At least what I went through, when you have to have someone help you out of the costume in order to do that." End quote. To be Ben Affleck today. All right, that's it on that one. Go for it.
America's favorite and most repetitive game, Temple Run, is going to be brought to the big screen by Warner Brothers and writer David Heyman. He wrote the Harry Potter movies, or at least a couple of them. Now, why the hell are they going to make a Temple Run movie? It's basically Indiana Jones, take out the narrative, and just have him running constantly, and all you see is his is him from the back, running from monkeys, crazy monkeys. The game is about running! There's no narrative! No narrative whatsoever! So why an adaption? It makes no sense! I don't understand!
Also from Collider.com, courtesy of Adam Chitwood. Here it is, folks. Insidious Chapter 3 will haunt theaters on April 3rd, 2015. Currently no director is slated, thanks again to James Wan being on Fast and Furious 7. So he's probably not going to be there for Chapter 3.
Universal breaks the all-time domestic box office, which the previous record was 1.335 or $1.335 billion in 2012. And they broke that with $1.352 billion. And that's all thanks to the early hits of this year, Fast 6 and Despicable Me Part 2. However, for the rest of the remaining of the year, we still have 47 Ronin and Mark Wahlberg's Lone Survivor, which are all Universal movies. I think it's safe to say that Universal can just plan on staying around the $1.352 billion mark from here on out.
All right, from Bloody Disgusting, again from BloodyDisgusting.com, also again courtesy of Mr. Disgusting, could Beetlejuice sequel also star Winona Ryder? That's right, folks, it has long been rumored that Michael Keaton would return as the ghost with the most. That's all been confirmed. Tim Burton is circling to direct because he's coming back. As if that weren't exciting as it is, Winona Ryder has told the Daily Beast that she may be on board too. Quote, I'm kind of sworn to secrecy, but it sounds like it might be happening. End quote. Also, just to sum it all up, quote, it's not a remake. It's 27 years later, and I have to say I love Lydia so much. She was a huge part of me. I would really be interested in what she is doing 27 years later. End quote. Well then, last but not least for me, following up that wonderful piece of Beetlejuice news, from TheGuardian.com, Disney's on-screen smoking ban applies even to Walt. The new biopic Saving Mr. Banks, starring Tom Hanks, edits out the mogul's lifelong tobacco habit. The article does discuss that this is tied to Disney's claim a few years back in 2007 when Bob Iger announced, quote, we expect that depictions of cigarette smoking in future Disney-branded films will be non-existent, end quote. Now, apparently there is one scene where he is seen putting out a cigarette, which is not visible. But that's it. I don't know. I think it's kind of stupid. I understand that Disney wants a standard of being family-friendly and not promoting smoking for children. This isn't exactly a kids' movie, for starters. Secondly, we already know that he was a fucking chain smoker anyway. The man died of lung cancer. So it just really seems to be going a little bit overboard for me on this one. For crying out loud, he had a tobacco shop in Disneyland in 1955.
And it's not like Disney does not support drunkenness.
That's right.
That can be shown in Pirates of the Caribbean where Jack Sparrow is completely hammered throughout the 12-hour running time movies, of the four Pirates of the Caribbean movies?
Yeah. I don't know, it just seems really kind of dumb that they are editing it out. People smoked. It's a period piece. But, whatever. Now, I guess let's just jump right into I'm the Only One Who Liked It.
Oh, yeah, I need to come up with a new little jingle for this. I'm not too sure what to do.
I don't know. Who is the one that liked this movie?
Not me.
Who is the one that wants to watch again?
Oh, you?
Who is the one that wants to watch the movie?
That was stupid.
I'm the only one that liked it. That's me, folks, watching the movie.
Aw, man.
Is that good?
I liked that movie and nobody else did.
I'd say let's just go with that. Just make that a little snippet, and then from then on, that's what we use. Maybe one day we'll find some people who can play some music behind it and we'll have our own little jingle. All right, so folks, the name of the segment is called I'm the Only One Who Liked It. And this is pretty much, for whatever reason, a movie that was not universally acclaimed. Maybe it was a straight DVD for whatever reason. Maybe it was critically acclaimed, but just didn't make any money in the movies because only the critics liked it. Or it could be something that's been universally panned. So we're going to start with me. And mine, I'm going to go to one of my go-to movies because when I talked about this last week, I said, you know, The Postman. So just to kind of give you an idea. However, that was not the movie that I'm picking. The movie that I'm picking is the cult favorite, because it was a success on home video, but it definitely bombed in the theater. Big Trouble in Little China. Okay? It is the 1986 American martial arts comedy film. It is directed by John Carpenter. And it stars Kurt Russell, a very young Kim Cattrall, Dennis Dunn, James Wong, and James Hong, and Victor Wong. This movie is about a guy, a truck driver named Jack Burton, who stumbles across, in his adventures to help a buddy of his, go to the airport to pick up Wang's fiance. They inadvertently come across a scheme for a small clan, an underground clan, to bring their fearless, eternal leader back to vigorous life and take over all of the world, I guess, eventually. And there's sex slaves involved and rare green-eyed Chinese women and bizarre marriages and the forerunner of Raiden from Mortal Kombat. People who can blow themselves up like completely to explosion. All along the backdrop of the cockiest motherfucking asshole in the history of cinema, Jack Burton. And I gotta tell you, it's just absolutely hilarious. You just have to sit back and accept that this movie is completely ridiculous, and is completely ridiculous on purpose. It's just that it's so completely ridiculous and so over the top, hardly anybody's willing to give it a chance, which is why it has a cult following, but barely made back half of its budget. I love this movie. I can't recommend it enough to anybody who loves offbeat comedy and just completely stupid stuff. It's also quintessentially 80s, and by God, you gotta check it out. Big Trouble in Little China.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
It's a pretty amazing planet we live on here, and a man would have to be some kind of fool to think we're all alone in this universe.
There is a hidden world where ancient evil weaves a modern mystery.
What's going on here? Is this some kind of
magic? The darkest magic.
They call it Little China.
Finally, we shall bring order out of chaos.
It's where Big Trouble was waiting for Jack Burton.
Who?
Jack Burton. Me.
Jack.
Jack.
Jack!
They told him to go to hell.
You make one move.
And that's just where he's going.
Somebody, I don't care who, tell me what is going on.
How are you gonna spring us?
I have no idea.
There are many mysteries, many unanswerable questions, even in a life as short as yours.
My destiny rests in your capable hands.
Hey, I'll do my best.
This is gonna take Cracker Jack timing, Wang.
One, two, three. You may be trapped.
Total concentration.
Safety.
Yeah.
You ready, Jack?
I was born ready.
Jack Burton's coming to rescue your summer.
Hey, what more can a guy ask for?
20th Century Fox presents Kurt Russell in John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China.
It's on the reflexes.
Well, for those that don't know, my movie,
The Match Game, because that's what it sounds like. It sounds like the music from The Match Game.
Pop quiz real quick. Who do you think performs a song? Who wrote this piece of music?
What the what we're listening to right now?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you. It sounds rather Hispanic in nature. But,
Burt Bacharach.
Okay, I could buy that. Yeah, I could totally buy that.
All right, so that is a classic theme song, but it is the most annoying theme song because throughout the entire movie, which I've yet to name, but I will shortly, it is playing, and the movie is well over 2 hours long, and it's constantly playing in the movie. Every time something goofy happens, or it's like a ha-ha-ha moment, that music comes in. Or if, like, David Niven does something, like, sexual or romantic, you know, instead of, like, some kind of boner thing going on, they play Burt Bacharach, which I guess might be the next best thing back in the 60s. So for those of you who have not caught on to this movie yet, it is from 1967, and it is
Casino Royale is too much for one James Bond. Join the Casino Royale fun movement.
Mr. Bond, I'm Lieutenant Mathis of the Special Police.
Peter Sellers is James Bond.
These are my credentials.
They appear to be in order.
Ursula Andress is James Bond. David Niven is James Bond. Woody Allen is James Bond.
My doctor says I can't have bullets enter my body at any time. What if I said I was pregnant?
Joanna Pettit is James Bond.
Rather warm in here, don't you think?
Cool it, Charlie.
Casino Royale is too much for one James Bond. Orson Welles is the heaviest heavy of Smirch. Dahlia Lavi is James Bond.
I'm the new secret weapon.
Casino Royale is too much for one James Bond.
Next.
Terrence Cooper is James Bond. Barbara Boucher is James Bond. Casino Royale is indestructibly wild.
Hello, sailor.
Indescribably funny.
Oh, you like that sort of thing, eh?
Join the Casino Royale fun movement.
Yes, a James Bond movie, but it was mainly a spoof of James Bond movies. This movie pretty much pertains nothing from Ian Fleming's Casino Royale. It only had the rights to the name itself. And that's kind of the reason why we didn't get a Casino Royale movie until 2006, 2007, when the, you know, Daniel Craig's first one. So, Casino Royale, the story. James Bond, played by David Niven, is forced out of retirement to investigate the disappearance of international spies, which eventually leads him to the evil Dr. Noah, the head of Smirsh, which is pretty much Smash from Dr. No. So, as you can tell, kind of right there, it's a spoof, Dr. No, Dr. Noah. Now, the movie sounds like a simple story, but it's not. It is actually far more complex and even bigger. It's huge. It's bigger than a James Bond movie. In my opinion, it is. Along the way, when James Bond is trying to track down this Dr. Noah and this head of Smirsh, Bond realizes that Smirsh might be out to get him. So he decides to hire these other goofy band of characters to take on the James Bond name and act as decoys while on various missions to aid Bond. And this is how you meet a vast array of characters. You have Vesper Lynd, played by Ursula Andrews, the very sexy Ursula Andrews, I'll say that, who is a retired British agent forced into service. Evelyn Trimble, who's played by Peter Sellers, his character is recruited by Vesper Lynd to challenge Le Sherif, who is played, well, I mean, Orson Welles can only play a character one way, pretty much, especially if he's making a little cameo and appearance in a movie. He just plays himself. Evelyn Trimble, Peter Sellers' character, has to challenge Le Sherif, Orson Welles, who is the financial agent of Smersh, to a game of baccarat at the Casino Royale, which the movie is pretty much named after, I guess, or that's the tie-in to it. Which, I guess, in a way, kind of plays into the book, because it's kind of, I mean, there is definitely aspects of the book that are in the movie, but because of legal reasons, they had to take alternate paths to get the characters where they needed to go and, you know, all that jazz. In the movie, you've also got Deborah Kerr, William Holden, Charles Boyer, and Woody Allen. That's right, Woody Allen. He's the one he plays Dr. Noah. Or I guess his real name turns out to be Jimmy Bond, who is actually the nephew of James Bond. And I just, for some reason, watching this movie for the first time, if James Bond had a nephew or had a family member that couldn't quite live up to his reputation, obviously his name would be Jimmy Bond, and it fits Woody Allen perfectly. Now, why I liked this movie. The idea itself, it's very interesting, and you can tell that a lot of thought was originally put into the making of this movie. I mean, you have these great locations, you have pretty decent action, sets, props, you have these moments, you have this really cool cinematography, especially with Peter Sellers' character when he's trying to woo this woman. He's walking through her apartment in like these cool reds and yellows and pink, the velvet looking bed. It honestly feels like the spy spoof to end all spy spoofs. In a way, it's sort of like Austin Powers, where technically and movie wise Austin Powers, the first one, International Man of Mystery, is the supreme spy spoof movie. But it still had this element to it that you knew you were watching a good movie. But with Casino Royale, due to some behind-the-scenes problems, actually quite a few historic behind-the-scenes problems, the movie is kind of, it starts off as a good movie, but then by the end, it just kind of turns into a movie that one poor director got stuck with having to glue together and create something out of, or to create something from. And what's really funny as hell is that thanks to Peter Sellers and Woody Allen, by watching this movie, you realize that there is so much stuff that Mike Myers ripped off and put in Austin Powers. Like the scene when Austin Powers is on the bed that spins around, and he's like, you know, he's doing the posing and, you know, saying like the shag now and all this stuff. Am I making you horny? Do I make you sexy? Well, pretty much that entire scene is taken from this movie. A lot of people think he's taking it from James Bond, or from the, I guess, the real Sean Connery 007 or Roger Moore movies. Or even In Like Flint, or Our Man Flint. But really, there are so many things from Austin Powers that he took from this movie. It's amazing, and originally it's fantastic when he realized this, because the original guy who created all this stuff, or who was the inspiration, was Peter Sellers. And he does a fantastic job. I absolutely love his character in this movie.
Mr. Bond. Miss Mr. Bond.
Yes.
I'm Miss Goodthighs.
I can see that. You've got your cork still in your bottle.
So I have. What are you going to do about it?
Stick your arm out.
The management of the Hotel Tropical present their compliments and hope you will enjoy your stay with us. Very sexy pants you're wearing, James.
Yes, they're the new 00 fronts. Tell me, Miss Goodthighs, how much did you tip the porter to let you in here?
I just showed him a little kindness.
How much?
Not too much. He's 83.
Ah, it's a good year.
But it's just done in a very, I guess, personable way, to where it feels like you're watching a real movie other than a spoof. Now, the problem with the movie, I mean, there is a reason why critics said that the movie was, quote, the most indulgent film ever made, or it lacked discipline and cohesion, or that it was chaotic, or an absolute mess. And this movie is a mess. This is where the problem kind of stemmed from. It had six different directors, and they were all in charge of various scenes and different characters. Like, one would direct the Woody Allen stuff, the other one would direct the David Niven stuff, one would direct the castle scenes, the other one would direct the casino scenes, one would be with Peter Sellers and Orson Welles, one would just be with Peter Sellers. So it had six directors, and one of them was John Huston himself. The other directors were Val Guest, Ken Hughes, Joseph McGrath, Robert Parrish, and like I said, there were many behind-the-scenes feuds, and many of them stemmed from Peter Sellers himself. One of the feuds is that Peter Sellers felt intimidated by Orson Welles, and it got so bad that other than a couple of shots, neither of them were in the same studio at the same time. They hated each other, and Welles had even been quoted to have said that he did not think much of Sellers, and he had refused to work with, quote, that amateur. Which is, I think, pretty interesting, because I think Peter Sellers is far from being an amateur. And now, due to the feuds between Sellers and directors, Sellers left the movie abruptly because he wanted to play the role more seriously. And he was annoyed that the movie was a comedy. And originally, when he was pitched the idea, it was a straight movie with comedic aspects to it. For those who don't know, what makes one of Peter Sellers' last later movies very special, Being There, there you go. And he was nominated for an Academy Award. And what made that movie special is because he always wanted an Academy Award for drama. Because he wanted to get away from being the goofy comedian, the slapstick comedian, and being typecast in those roles, and he wanted to be a dramatic actor. He wanted to prove himself. He wanted to show that he is a prolific performer. And so with this role, because that the movie was going into the farcical, going to the direction of comedy, or that really it was a farce comedy, he went back and improvised scenes and rewrote certain scenes to make them play out more seriously. But that didn't play out well with the director, and Peter Sellers just left. He left the movie before the ending was ever filmed. So whenever you watch the movie, you see the climax building up, and when it finally gets to it, Peter Sellers' character is not there. And I don't want to spoil the movie, the ending especially, for those who plan to see it, and I hope you do, because it's a very special movie, and in some way it means a lot, because though this movie has so many faults, unfortunately those faults overshadow the really cool, the really groovy aspects that this movie has produced, or this movie contains. It's funny, it's really cool to look at. To me, I could watch this movie multiple times. Well, maybe not in one day, but, you know, once a year even. It's just, I just think that the movie is that prolific. And to me, well, maybe not prolific, but to me, the behind-the-scenes backstory, the feud, compels me to like this movie anymore. So yeah, the movie grossed worldwide $41.7 million. It was still a hit. And today, $41.7 million equals $292 million, and that is in today's money. So again, Casino Royale from 1967 is my pick. I highly recommend it. To those with an open mind, of course.
So I think we're down to the last segment, are we not?
Yes, sir.
All right, then. Let's get to it.
The movies!
end. This week, the movies were Thor, The Dark World, 12 Years a Slave, and Dallas Buyers Club. Where do you want to begin, sir?
Let's knock out Thor real quick.
Dallas Buyers Club it is, then. All right. Dallas Buyers Club. 2013 American biographical drama directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, starring Matthew McConaughey, Jared Leto, Jennifer Garner, and Steve Zahn. This film is based on the true life tale of Ron Woodruff. Yes, who was basically this guy who was attacked by the FDA for basically circumventing them in the 80s because people desperately needed drugs for HIV and AIDS and couldn't get them at the time. And he saw a problem and decided to solve it.
Arigato.
What are you doing here?
Well, I live here.
Where's Rayon? Your roommates?
Not exactly. What are you doing here?
Roger Thompson. This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DDC, anything but that poison you're hawking. So you ever wear any color? Seems like every time I see you, all I see is white. You got white coat, white shoes, white...
Tell Rayon I was looking for him. And I am telling my patients to stay away from here.
Why?
Excuse me.
So you want to go grab steak sometime? I know it's red.
I gotta say, for me, I was expecting a good movie, and I got a great movie. You know, if he can keep, if Matthew McConaughey can keep doing movies like Dallas Buyers Club and Mud, this guy's gonna be a shoo-in for an Oscar. Anytime, I mean, just, I can see it happening. And then people are gonna be scratching their heads going, how the hell did the guy who did Sahara end up with an Oscar? Well, keep watching movies like this. Movies like this, movies like Mud, movies like Lincoln Lawyer. And you'll understand why. You'll also then be like, but didn't he do The Paperboy? And I'll have to say, shut up! That's all I can tell you.
But then he did A Time to Kill, which he was really good in.
True. This is, I don't know, the characters were believable. I'm really kind of starting to like Jennifer Garner as an actress, especially after performances like in Butter and whatnot. Even though it was a little over the top in Butter, and I had my issues with Butter, I thought she's still... she is definitely really coming into her own as an actress, I feel. Due to the nature of the story, there's nothing really grandiose in the cinematography. It's not the way that it's shot. This is all about the way that the story is told. This comes down to the writing and the direction. The actors really give great performances overall. And you can clearly see that there was a story to be told in a heartfelt way. I like this movie a lot. I highly recommend this movie to anyone. It's not a perfect movie. I felt that the movie was probably about a good 10 minutes, maybe even 15 minutes too long. So it does drag in a few spots, but still worth seeing. It's definitely something to check out. 4.5 stars for me.
Yeah, this is an excellent movie. I mean, it's very involving, and like what Matt said, there's really nothing technical about it that is, you know, like outstanding cinematography. It's just a very involving movie. It feels like, in a way, that you're kind of going along this journey with him. Like, whenever he's driving the car, the camera's right there in the car with him. Whenever you're in the hotel room with him, his office that he calls his office, you're right there with him. You have this feeling that you are in these rooms watching these scenes play out, opposed to you're sitting at a movie theater watching a movie. And, God, I gotta say, I have not had an experience this immersive. I mean, it's happened maybe one or two other... Probably, I think, with Prisoners and Captain Phillips. I mean, honestly, these are some of the only movies that I've seen this year where I had that effect, where I never checked my watch or thought about checking my watch, or I never looked away from the screen during any period of time. This is just a really good movie, and Matthew McConaughey again proves that he is a fantastic and a very involving actor. I mean, you look at A Time to Kill, you look at Ed Wood, even. I mean, he did great in Ed Wood. It's a comedic role, and I guess there's some drama in it, but he did fantastic in that movie. And like Matt said, Lincoln Lawyer, he's just a great, great actor, and I am looking forward to seeing every other movie that he comes out with. So, 5 stars for me.
All right. Well, excellent, excellent. All right. Now, I was messing around with him, but okay, let's go ahead and tackle Thor. Let's go ahead and knock this out now. This is clearly a movie that is just meant to capitalize on, oh, look, it's Marvel. Look, it's an Avenger. Quick, look at me.
Obvious. It's super obvious that this is the case.
It is super, super obvious. I mean, let me just sum it up here. For me, it's a 3-star movie. I liked it. There's absolutely nothing special about this movie. It's a popcorn flick. Don't expect any good story. Where I gave the original Thor for at least 4 stars. I'm pretty sure I gave you can really see that there were rewrites in effect here. I am a huge Christopher Eccleston fan. He plays the bad guy in this movie, and they just, once again, with the focus being on Loki as the villain, they take it away from the actual bad guy. Christopher Eccleston doesn't even get a chance to be a bad guy. He's just a piss-poor plot device to help keep Natalie Portman and Chris Hemsworth together. And it's completely obvious. And it just is such a bummer, because not only is it wasted for that role, you don't even, unless you know who it is, you have no way to tell that it's him because of all of the prosthetics and everything. And then, of course, half the time, he's speaking in an alien language. And then when he's not even speaking in alien language, he's still got kind of this computery digital kind of a voice. It's a decent movie. They're clearly gonna, you know, get all their money out of it. I think Kenneth Branagh should have come back. I really don't know why he didn't come. I think this would have been a better movie if he had come back for it, but whatever. Maybe Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit will be redemptive for him, since he's directing that one instead. I was disappointed because I was really looking forward to it, and it just could have been so much better, and it wasn't. I still liked it. It ekes in at 3 stars. This is not like a solid 3-star movie. It's an eking it in at 3 stars. That's pretty much all I gotta say.
I think it's safe for me to say that I am officially sick and tired of Marvel movies. Sick and tired. Because, it's obvious that this was, I don't want to say a cash grab. This movie has had some serious rewrites to it. And it is completely obvious. And a lot of it, I believe, if I remember correctly, reading movie news from a year ago or so, that they did more reshoots with Loki to bring Loki to have more scenes with him in it, because, you know, there's just this big popularity with his character. Even though they, well, can't spoil the end of the movie, let's just say there's really no point to it after the end of this movie. So it just seems like they were just doing it just to make people happy for the time being. But while they were they were giving the fans what they wanted, they were completely keeping Christopher Eccleston from being the bad guy that he could have been. Which would have been a lot better, because we know the story behind Thor and Jane. We know about everybody wants to take over the frickin' galaxy, and for the world especially. There needs to be something more to the movie other than the same stuff that we've been seeing. And it seems like now with the Avengers, pretty much all of New York was pretty, I mean, a big portion of New York was destroyed by these aliens from a different dimension or galaxy or whatever. And now it's kind of like, you know, what can we do now to top Avengers? Well, let's do the same exact thing, but make them look like elves from an episode of Doctor Who, and have them attack London. I smell money, and I think that will work beautifully. And that's what they did, and they throw in some really stupid humor from Kat Dennings' character, which, again, throwaway character, with some of the worst lines I've ever heard this year in movies. And there you have, put it all in a blender of crap and entertainment. I mean, there is some genuinely entertaining pieces in it. Oh, you cannot forget the use of green screen, because it is very prominent throughout this entire movie that this movie was both shot for 3D and they were all on, you know, three-dimensional or standing in front of blue screens or whatever. Because you look at the movie and there's no depth to it. There's no feeling that you're watching characters in a alternative galaxy. It just feels like you're watching, you know, these people dressed in goofy costumes standing in front of fake scenery pretending to stop evil Doctor Who elves from taking over Asgard and London, England. And yeah, that's kind of what I got from the movie. I mean, there were some really cool shots of the movie, which I'm sure if I saw it in 3D, it would have looked a lot better. And I think this movie kind of falls into the realm of, or fall into the category of one of those movies that were shot for 3D and that they were really looking for what would look really cool in 3D opposed to what would look really cool and what would be really cool for the movie in general, that I just kind of felt shafted for, you know, by watching this movie. Like, I didn't get the full experience because I didn't pay the extra $3.50 or $4 service fee to see it in 3D. Yeah, I mean, characters use solely as plot devices. That's why Jane was on Asgard for the brief time that she had the stuff in. Yeah, you know, yeah, I just, you know, I guess if you're a fan, you might enjoy it more than me. This is my second least favorite Marvel movie. My first least favorite was Iron Man 2, which I didn't like that one. This one, I'm going to have to put it at probably 2.5 stars. I mean, I enjoyed it, but memories are not fond looking back on it. So, there you go. 2.5 out of 5.
Fair enough. All right, so he's giving it the okay rating. I'm still going to stand firm at 3 stars, letting again, it eked in. So that just leaves us with 12 Years a Slave, the 2013 British-American epic historical drama film, which is, of course, an adaptation of the 1853 biography 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. This movie is directed by Steve McQueen and stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, I apologize if I have butchered that name, Michael Fassbender, Benedict Cumberbatch, Paul Dano, Paul Giamatti, Lupita Nyong'o, Brad Pitt, lots of pretty cool names in this movie here. This movie is exactly what I expected it to be. I don't really have... I don't know what I'm... It's a guy who is a free man and does pretty well for himself as a free man. He is a carpenter. He can play the violin. And he ends up getting hoodwinked, I guess, kidnapped, and sold into slavery. Over the course of 12 years, he works for a rather benevolent master, and then of course a super cruel master, and loses his faith in God and humanity and everything, slowly kind of regains it, and eventually gets out of slavery.
That's it. Do not look in his direction. Continue on.
That's it.
Found him, master. Brought her back just as instructed. What'd you just now tell her? What'd you say to Pets?
No words were spoken, none of consequence.
You're a liar.
You're a damn liar.
I saw you talking with her. Tell me.
Can I speak of what did not occur?
Oh, Master Black!
Bro!
Master! You come here.
Master, I thought...
I said come here!
I brought her back just like you...
Come here!
Master!
There's a lot of... feel bad... I don't know. I just get so tired. I do. I just get so tired of being made to feel bad. And that's what I feel like these movies do. That's what I feel these movies do.
This movie played the movie. It played all that stuff completely straight. It wasn't about, you know, they weren't saying. I mean, it's about slavery, so you're obviously going to have that aspect to it. But then he had the good master, or the decent master, I guess. But then it also played into the fact where, which I thought was very interesting, because I don't think a lot of movies that are about slavery really ever touch on, and that is. A slave making the choice of being submissive about it because he knows, well, you know, if I don't say anything, if I don't speak up, if I change my ways and conform, then, you know, that's my only way of getting out of it.
I disagree. You've got Roots. You've got Glory.
Lately, well, okay, let me rephrase that and say, lately, the past, I mean, you have, well, Amistad was vastly,
okay,
is
Amistad.
Vastly different. It's a pretty, yeah.
Well, okay, what about the Lee Daniels as the butler?
That movie is completely different, because that one is a good example
even
of
even though
it
it's
being,
not about slavery, it's, okay.
It's shoved down
it's
your
not
throat.
About,
yeah, I totally agree with you on that.
It's not about slavery. It's still about... trying to work within the system to break the cycle of the system. Even though in this particular instance, we have a man who was clearly, the whole issue of slavery aside, which we all know slavery is bad and whatever. But the issue of slavery aside, this man was, you know, clearly persecuted and suffered a great injustice. But, I don't know, I just, it was not in your face about it. I will grant you that. This was not one of those where it's in your face. I just, and it was well made. It was well shot. It was well written. I'm not trying to take away from the fact that this is a solid movie. This is a good movie. In terms of every quantifiable aspect, I'm just kind of tired of it. It's just, for me, it has been overdone.
But how do you make a movie pertaining to this kind of story without touching on? I mean, it's kind of the same. I mean, it could be the same thing about with blacks watching movies about. White cops having to deal with black thugs, you know, from, you know, I'm sure that stuff can bug the hell out of them too.
Sure, but to be fair, I don't watch that either. There's only so much of that I can take as well, because it's the same thing. And even then, it's the same thing there. It's, oh look, thug bad, cops beat on, and or... in that situation, cops abusing power, and now thugs have a reason to take it out on them. I mean, it's the same thing. I don't know. There's just... I get that this is a true story. I get that... well, let me rephrase it. Based on a true story. And I get that slavery really, really happened. There's just none of these things are being disputed here. It's just that for me, I'm just tired. I'm just tired of seeing it. And quite frankly, it's like this. One of the reasons why I liked Django Unchained, which also dealt with slavery and also dealt with women being raped and taken advantage of and slaves getting beaten.
But in a very different way.
True.
In a very non-serious way.
In a non-serious way, but at the same time, in a very, I've had all I can stand and I'm not going to take it, I'm not going to, and I can't stand no more. You know, and I don't know how else to say this, so if it's offensive, it's offensive. And I apologize, I guess, in advance. It was almost as if you see what with the character of Django, he is empowered to take the situation into his own hands and redeem himself and his wife for all that they have gone through, and in the same and on the same token, get rid of bad people. And so that, and then of course all the Tarantino-esque everything that else went into it made that enjoyable. It wasn't white people bad. And that's just what these movies make me feel like. It's getting to the point where it's kind of soul crushing for me. That's all. Again, I'm not trying to take away from the fact that this is a good movie. This movie, 4 stars for me. I get 4 stars. This is a good movie. It's just the subject matter for me, tiresome. I'm just tired, and I don't want to see them anymore. And that's all I'm trying to say. So that's all I'm going to say.
All right. All right, 12 Years a Slave, 5-star movie for me. If I could give it any more stars than Dallas Buyers Club, I totally could. I saw these movies back to back. I saw 12 Years first, then Dallas Buyers Club. And, man, that was the most entertaining, close to 3 hours of theater sitting down and watching I've ever had, in a while at least. This is excellent. Again, an involving movie. It's one of the best movies about this subject, because I love how it shows both sides of the story. You have the... it's not just the mean, evil slave owner, the master or whatever. First, he's with the nicer one, the better one, I guess. And then he is traded off to the drunk one, the one with the problems with his wife. And I just love the... Michael Fassbender is just absolutely fantastic in this movie, which I think he's really good and pretty much every other thing he's in. He's one of those actors for me. Just how he is in some way controlled by his wife, but we are in the point of his life where he has pretty much given up that control that she has on him, and just wants to do whatever he wants, and does it very drunkenly. And it was just very interesting on seeing those little bitty moments kind of play out between him and his wife, involving this one slave that he has certain relations with, that he favors for various reasons. Another great thing about this movie is that it doesn't overdo anything. Specifically, it doesn't overdo anything, unless it absolutely needs to, and when it does, it is most effective. And these, for example, are for the whipping scenes and the hanging scenes. There is one scene where Paul Dano's character, he is going to hang him because of a altercation in which Solomon proves him wrong while building a shed or a barn or something. And so he hangs him. And while somebody comes to his aid, gets rid of Paul Dano, and he's left hanging there with only the tips of his the tips of his toes are touching the ground, and yet it's mud, so it's slipping, and so he's constantly in a state of struggle and I guess even suffocation for hours, and it kind of does this interesting time lapse where you slowly start seeing the other slaves coming out of their shacks, and they don't even go to help him out. They just grab their hose and they grab their their farming equipment, and they go off to tend crops, or they go off and to carry on their day, completely walking past them. One of them's even humming a tune and singing, and kids are playing right behind them. And Solomon is choking, nearing death. And yet, it's this prolonged shot for, God, I mean, it felt like 10 minutes, but it's probably just a couple minutes. It's just, God, you just want to help the guy, and it's kind of amazing seeing that the state of these people are in to where they can't do such a thing. I mean, it's one of their kind. It's one of their group of people. It's one of their brethren, I guess, that it, you would think that they would feel compelled to help, but they can't because in fear of something horrible happening, being whipped or them being hung as well or getting hanged as well. So it's just scenes like that. And like I was saying, the whippings, there's one whipping scene closer to the end of the movie where it's, God, it's so intense and you see it happening. And, you know, it's just, God, it's just how it's done. The movie is just so artistically done that every shot, every scene, it looks like, if you can pause it, it looks like you're looking at an oil painting in a way. I just love the earthy textures and the greens, and every once in a while you get this brightness of color, whether it's from the greens or the oranges or the browns or the white, the blue sky, or just something. It's just, or the white, I mean, just like the cotton itself. God, just the pictures this movie creates is just fantastic. So it's just wonderful. I mean, I give this movie 5 stars, 5+ stars if I could. Definitely an awards contender. Very different from Dallas Buyers Club, but it's very much effective. And like I said, to me, it's one of the better presentations or representations of the subject. And I think, personally, it was done in a very effective way. So, again, 5 stars, 12 Years a Slave.
Eliza. Stop! Stop your wailing! You let yourself be overcome by sorrow, you will drown in it.
Have you stopped crying for your children? You make no sounds, but will you ever let them go in your heart?
They are as my flesh.
Then who is distressed? Do I upset the master and the mistress? Do you care less about my loss than their well-being?
Master Ford is a decent man.
He is a slaver.
Under the circumstances.
Under the circumstances, he's a slaver. But you truckle at his boot.
No.
You luxuriate in his favor.
I survive. I will not fall into despair. I will offer up my talents to Master Ford. I will keep myself hardy till freedom is opportune.
Oh, Ford is your opportunity. You think he does not know that you are more than you suggest. But he does nothing for you. Nothing. You are no better than prized livestock. Call for him. Call. Tell him of your previous circumstances and see what it earns you, Solomon. So you settle into your role as Platt, then?
My back is thick with scars for protesting my freedom. Do not accuse me.
I accuse you of nothing. I cannot accuse. I have done dishonorable things to survive, and for all of them, I have ended up here. No better than if I had stood up for myself. God, forgive me. Solomon, let me weep for my children.
Outstanding. All right, so I guess that brings us to the end of the show. And for next week, we're going to bring back 3 Squared. We're going to be doing Worst Actor Replacements in a Movie Sequel. Yeah. So that ought to be fun. The movies for next week are going to be The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, Starbuck, and 2003's Old Boy, in preparation for the one that's coming out in 2 weeks.
2 foreign movies in one episode?
Can we handle it? Well, of course we can. We love foreign movies here at the SLS Cast.
And we like to read. So.
Yes. We like to make ourselves feel important when we read our movies. That's right. That's not a contradiction in terms at all. Okay, so I guess, given that, it must be time for the spiel.
Spiel on.
Alrighty, the music you've been listening to, as always, has been brought to us by Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at facebook.com, reverbnation.com, and myspace.com, /Cries of Solace. We, of course, are still the SLS Cast. You can check us out at slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at the SLS Cast. You can go to Facebook, search the SLS Cast, like us there, and of course, subscribe to us on iTunes. So, until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Greta Garbo, I can say this. Being a movie star, and this applies to all of them, means being looked at from every possible direction. You are never left at peace. You're just fair game.
There was a real bar called the Corova based on the book. It's closed now, and it had come back up, reopened. But oh God, damn these sad, lean times.
Good day, y'all.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.